We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program. We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, at the controls this morning is Jason Croft. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with historian Sean Willance. He has been a professor of history for quite a long time. He's written about American history. He's the author of the book, The Rise of American Democracy, which won the Bancroft Prize, most recently, The Age of Reagan. He is also the historian in residence for Bob Dylan's official website and has an interesting connection, more than one interesting connections with Bob Dylan. When he was growing up, that is when Sean Willance was growing up, his family had a bookstore in Greenwich Village in New York City, a very famous bookstore, a place that was both very important to the writers known as the Beats and also the people who were there in New York City who were involved in the folk revival there. When he was young, when he was actually 13 years old, he went with his dad to a concert, which now is a rather famous Dylan concert that took place on Halloween 1964. And that was his first time seeing live Bob Dylan. And definitely Dylan and his music made a big impression on him, for it's been something that he's been listening to for a long time. And we're talking this morning about a book that he's authored. The title is Bob Dylan in America. It is published by Doubleday. And it's a book that tries to look at Dylan and his influences. So how it is that he reflected his time and what it is that he and his music have to say about America. It's an interesting project, and I appreciate Sean Willance taking some time and talking with us this morning. And of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening can call in with questions. We hope people will try to be brief, but certainly questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you're listening. That's 800-222-9455. And then we have the email, too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you'd like to call in, ask questions, make comments, you can do that. And Professor Willance, hello.
David, great to be here. Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I guess I have to say, you know, some of the music here that we'll talk about, I haven't heard in a long time myself. And one of the things that I was doing here as a way to try to get myself into the proper frame of mind is I've been listening to Blonde on Blonde. Mm-hmm. When there's a major section in the book about that record and how it was made. This was 1966. I think a lot of people feel that it was one of his best and a very important one in the development of his style. And I feel that I'm kind of coming to it with fresh ears because, you know, it's been a while. It's been quite a while since I listened to it. And at the same time, I guess I think, you know, he has such a big body of work, and we have been listening to his music for such a long time. For me, though, it's really hard to imagine what it would have been like to be hearing it for the first time, to really be hearing it for the first time. Do you recall what you thought, what you felt, what it was like when you were 13 years old and you were there with your dad at that concert?
Oh, at the concert in 64.
Yeah.
Actually, I wasn't with my dad. My dad had scored the tickets. He gave it to me and a cousin win.
Oh, okay. Okay.
By that time, I was young, but, you know, we were all very smug and precocious. We were, the bee's knees. And so we showed up to Philharmonic Hall, and he sang a lot of his older, more familiar anthems and civil rights songs and political songs, and that was all familiar. So it was very much like a Dylan concert like any other. But he was also playing new songs, things that he had composed that were not yet recorded. And those songs just blew us away. I mean, things like Gates of Eden "It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding." I mean, these were songs that we could barely comprehend them. We could get snatches of lyrics, and it wasn't always clear what, in fact, the lyrics said. But so it was a mixture. But it was he was in a great mood that night. It was I write about this in the book itself. He's kind of, you know, he's just very merry, and there's a lot of badinage between the audience and him. It's as if he's in a folk club, you know, downtown in the Village rather than up in, you know, in Tony Philharmonic Hall. But it was just a great evening.
Yeah. I know here in the introduction to the book you talk about maybe the first music that you heard before you actually saw him, I think, was when you and some friends of yours were listening to his second record, Freewheelin'. And when you say here in the book that you said that you didn't understand all of it, but what you did understand, some of that was funny, some of it was uplifting. He said, you write here, a lot of it was frightening.
Yeah.
What about it was frightening?
Well, there are images there of, you know, black branches bleeding. And, I mean, it's a song of apocalypse in some ways, but it's a song of images. It's one image after another, some of which are really scary. You know, it's a person walking out and down a road, basically, and he's recounting to his parent what he had seen out there. And some of the things that he sees, you know, I saw a young girl, her body was burning. I mean, this is before the Vietnam War. So, you know, to a 12, 13-year-old, it was pretty scary stuff.
Yeah.
But powerfully scary. I mean, it really, you know, it burnt itself in your mind, some of those images. And I've carried around with them, some of them around with me, actually, ever since.
Yeah. As I've been listening to Blonde on Blonde, I guess one of the things that struck me about it, and maybe for the first time, is that the songs, they have, on one hand, they have a certain quality of accessibility in the sense that they're sort of plain. And yet, when you really start to try to grasp them, they also have a very elusive quality. And it's very interesting that I have that reaction, that both of those kinds of reactions.
Yeah. I mean, there are many levels to the songs. Some of the songs are easier than others. A song like Visions of Johanna, it's one level a very simple story about it, you know, a love triangle. But because the language is so rich and because the allusions are so rich, you can take it in a number of different directions. Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat, I don't know, that's pretty straightforward. if somewhat zany, right? I mean, it's not the usual, it's not your usual, you know, bugger off, I'm not in love with you anymore, you betrayed me song. It's just wilder than that. In that 60s pop vein. But also, I mean, you know, and this is really what I'm trying to get at in the book overall, I mean, there are so many different forms of both music and literature that he is drawing on that kind of focus in on Bob Dylan, if you will, from, you know, take Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat. I mean, that's a straight 12-bar blues could have been out of Chicago. But what he does with it is something that's, you know, something that Muddy Waters never would have done. He does that with everything that he comes across, everything that he touches, and he touches a lot. So Blonde on Blonde is interesting to me at some level, or became more interesting, once I figured out all that was in there. And when you figure out all that is in there, all of the influences, then it becomes much more intelligible and much more impressive.
Yeah. Clearly, the thing that's interesting, that interests you, that you're thinking about is this business of influences, where all of the various things in American music, American popular culture, American history that Dylan has drawn on, and how he has taken that and done his own unique thing with it. And I guess if you'll forgive me for bringing up Joni Mitchell, there was kind of a big dust up back last spring because she gave an interview to the LA Times. And talking about her, she was talking about herself and her music. Mm-hmm. There was one, though, in about two lines worth, where she says some things about Bob Dylan, and apparently the interviewer here made the mistake of mentioning her and Bob in the same breath, and she didn't much like it. And she went on to say some pretty harsh stuff, saying that he was a plagiarist, that he was a fake. She used the word deception in talking about him. Mm-hmm. And it made a lot of people angry, and they came to Bob's defense. And I suppose some people said, yes, right on, Joni. But that really gets us this idea about, well, songwriters, what exactly are they doing? And, you know, what counts as original? And is there anybody who you can say truly is a complete original and hasn't really taken some idea or some sort of thought or something from someplace else?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's many ways to get at this, David. There's the old thing that was called the folk process, right? That folk songs are always rewrites of other folk songs, and that when Bob Dylan got involved early in his career with Pete Seeger and the whole folk revival, I mean, he did that. I mean, he uses all sorts of tunes. He uses the tune. There's a new album out of his demo tapes from 1962, 64. And he sings the song Farewell, which is his song, except it's the exact same melody and some of the sentiments from an old Irish song called The Leaving of Liverpool. I mean, this happens all the time. But what Dylan does, I mean, in some ways, actually, Joni's right, even though I came to Bob's defense. But Joni's right in the sense that he is deceptive. But every performer is deceptive. I mean, every performer is hiding behind a mask in some way. And Dylan is perhaps more upfront about that, but there is deception always, because these are, in fact, illusions at some level. What Dylan has done, I think, is to be much more sophisticated and much more inclusive and much more interesting in his amalgamation of other people's stuff. You know, he can look at a novel by a true life story of a Japanese gangster, which has nothing to do with whatever song he's writing about, but lift certain lines from that record and just from that book, certain images, it's never an entire thought, and translate them entirely so that the words were written by somebody else, but they take on an entirely different meaning in the context of a Dylan song.
Mm-hmm.
He has done that, particularly over the last 15 years or so, with a kind of concentrated, self-conscious, but also very inventive and playful at times, but very serious way, which is it's a kind of extension of the folk process, but it's very much his own.
Well, and I think that you know, as you think about the archetype of the singer-songwriter that emerges maybe around this time, or maybe a little bit later, I guess you do, you know, the earnest person standing up there all alone with the microphone and the guitar.
Yeah.
And you have this idea that what this person has done is they're ripping open their chest.
Yes.
And they're showing you their heart, and they're singing about real stuff and about them as a real person and what really happened to them. And everything comes out of their immediate personal life experience.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that while that's maybe the way it looks, or that's the way we want it to be, I guess you have to say, to one extent or another, these people are a character that they have created,
right,
that they're giving us,
right,
and that illusion of real, genuine, you know, I'll tear my heart in my chest and show it to you beating,
yeah,
here in front of you, that's just not, that's maybe never true.
Well, it's never completely true, and also, you know, the true confessions mode of singer-songwriting, you know, I mean, you can take it so far before it gets kind of boring, right? I mean, you know, we all have adolescent angst of one kind or another, and okay, I kind of get it. And it begins to sound a little bit like rock and roll or bad rock and roll, which is just, you know, boy meets girl, girl breaks up with boy, boy feels like, you know, a dunce. That kind of thing. I mean, there's so many things you can do with it unless you try to raise it to another level. And really talented songwriters will do that. I mean, James Taylor, in his early work, took a story of his, you know, losing his great love and managed to turn it into art. Dylan does the same kind of thing often. Not always. It's not always about him. It's about some imagined character. But often it was, especially early on. But when you listen to a song like Boots of Spanish Leather from, I guess it's from Another Side, or maybe it's from the other one. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You know, it's a song about, you know, his girlfriend has left, and she's over in Italy, and except he makes out to be in Spain. And he misses her, and she's not coming back. Well, that actually happened. But, you know, what he did was to raise that to a much higher level of universality. It's about loss, in a way that we can all relate to. It's not just we're interested about his, you know, travails and how bummed out he is.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Sean Wilentz. He is a professor in the American Revolutionary Era at Princeton University, has written a lot about American history, but he's also the historian in residence for Bob Dylan's official website and has written a new book. It's titled Bob Dylan in America. It's published by Doubleday, and you certainly can, it's not a biography, but certainly you will learn a lot about Dylan and his music if you read this book. In addition, maybe you'll learn a few other things about America, at least the ideas that he wanted to think a little bit about Dylan and his place in America, how each shaped the other. And the book's out now, and if you want to take a look at it, you certainly should do that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. There are some influences on him that certainly you write about and are very clear, and I think people will understand that Dylan was influenced by other folk performers that came before him, people like Pete Seeger and maybe Woody Guthrie, of course, is going to be a big one. Mm-hmm. But you also look at other influences that maybe aren't quite so obvious, and I think maybe some people might be sort of surprised that, in fact, in this book that's about Bob Dylan, what you begin with is a discussion of Aaron Copland.
That great folk rocker.
You also talk about Allen Ginsberg. Well, the two, Dylan and Ginsberg, actually met. Well, Dylan never got to meet Aaron Copland, but you feel that somehow there are some connections between particularly the way they work, these two men.
Well, that ends up, looking back, you can see that. But, you know, I wanted to do a different kind of influence story there. You know, the question of the connection between Bob Dylan and Allen Ginsberg is straightforward, although there was a lot that had yet to be written about, and I found out about, and I was able to do that. With Copland, I was trying to find another way to talk about Dylan's connection with the folk revival and with the popular front of the 1930s and 1940s that gave rise to the folk revival. And the way that's usually done is the direct connection to Guthrie, who's his great hero, and Pete Seeger, who kind of picks him up very early on, and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who was Guthrie's acolyte. I mean, but that story's been told, and it's been told well. I didn't want to, eliminate it, but I wanted to get at the connection, the world out of which those guys came in the 1940s, Seeger, Guthrie, and then later Elliott, and look at that wider congeries, that wider combination of forces that was out there in the 30s and 40s in American culture. And it was very political, and it was very much in the popular front mode, which meant, doing as much as you could with, American folk song, American culture, the culture of the people, to try and, turn that into, well, a political weapon in the case of the more direct political people. Well, Copland was part of all of that. I ran across a review that Pete Seeger's father actually wrote about a performance of Copland's at one of the Communist Party venues in 1934. Copland was part of all of that. He saw his music in part as an extension of all of that, first in its revolutionary modernist form, and then in its more folksy form that we're more familiar with, Rodeo, Billy the Kid, Appalachian Spring, things like that, using American folk music and raising it to the level of art. Now, that's not what got Bob Dylan doing what he did, and I make that very, very clear in the book. But what I wanted to understand was what was there about the larger cultural mood, the larger cultural impulses in that part of American life in the 30s and 40s that was going to give rise to the kind of cultural mood that was going to help inspire Bob Dylan. And, Woody Guthrie is the direct way around it. Another way, more indirect, but I think just as telling, is that of Aaron Copland.
I'd like to play a little bit of music here, and we want to play, I thought we'd play something from the 64, from the live concert, and maybe, why don't we play Hard Rain? How about that? That's something that people, at least there's a song people are going to know, but maybe this particular version is a not one that they maybe are familiar with. Let's hear that. Well, that's at least a little bit of Hard Rain. And I don't know if Professor Wilentz, if there anything in particular you might want to say about the song or about the
That performance was from the Philharmonic Hall concert that I went to.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of part of the reason that I thought it would be might be kind of fun to play. Just again to make that point that was you, here were you sitting in the audience, 13 years old.
Yeah, that was one we all knew, and you could hear the response at the beginning was it was a rapturous when he played his Bob Dylan's greatest hits, except it'd only been around for a year and a half. But, there they were. I saw Black Branches, the bleeding Black Branches right there. That's pretty scary stuff. It's a take on an old English folk song called Lord Randall, which is a kind of search and discovery song. I mean, the boy goes out, and the handsome young man goes out, and he sees things in the world, and he comes back to tell about it. And that's what Dylan's doing here, except what he sees is a very bleak series of bleak encounters. Dead dogs and babies with sharp swords, and it's kind of it's just very frightening. And so he's describing a journey through a. Not exactly surreal. It's just a very, bleak and frightening landscape. And then he comes back to tell about it, and he tells the person who's asking him all the questions. But then he says he's going to sing it off the mountaintops, and he'll know his song well before he starts singing. And there's something prophetic about it. In fact, when Allen Ginsberg first heard that song in when he had returned from India in 1963, he said he wept. He wept with a sense that the illumination of beat poetry, as he saw it, his illumination, was going on. He had been handed down to another performer because he heard in that song some of the gifts of American prophecy that he had imputed to Jack Kerouac and others. Mm-hmm. It's one of Dylan's eternal wonderful songs. It's one of the ones I think people will still be listening to and reading and listening to, 100 years from now.
Yeah. Another thing that you certainly talk about a lot in the book, deal with, is the importance of the beats, and particularly of Allen Ginsberg to Dylan and his work. And I mentioned back at the beginning that when you were growing up, your family had this bookshop in Greenwich Village, and it was, I hope I get this right, in your uncle's apartment that was above the store.
Right.
Day after Christmas, 1963, Ginsberg and Dylan meet.
Yeah, I only found out about that later on, and I can't even remember being at that. It was a party that my uncle threw day after Christmas, business season was over. Alan and Peter Orlovsky, his lover, had just returned from India via California, and were staying at the apartment because they didn't have a place to live, so they were looking for a place to live, looking for an apartment, which they eventually found on the east side. But they're throwing this party as a kind of combination celebration of the end of the Christmas season and a welcome home for Alan and Peter. And so Al Aronowitz, who was a local reporter, a guy named Al Aronowitz, who had kind of inveigled himself or worked his way into Bob Dylan's inner circle, thought it would be a good idea to. He heard about the party. Al heard about everything that was going on in the village in those days. And thought it would be a good idea to, and was invited, and thought it would be a good idea to bring Dylan along to meet Allen Ginsberg, which in fact happened. And it happened at an interesting time in both their lives and careers, because Dylan was already frustrated with the folk revival, the limits, the constraints of the folk revival, of having to be, some person's idea of the successor to Woody Guthrie and to be the troubadour of the revolution and so forth. He was getting kind of sick of all of that. And it was in the aftermath of Kennedy's assassination, actually, which helped explain his disillusionment with all of that. And then Ginsberg had returned from India, had found Buddha, had gone through his own spiritual transformations, and the beat scene that he had left behind in 1961 was kind of crumbling. Kerouac wasn't really on the scene as much, although he was around. That world was ending. A new world was beginning. And they affected each other, I think, pretty profoundly. I mean, Ginsberg gave to Dylan a way out of the folk revival in some ways, a way to think about, especially the lyrical content, as much more expansive, much more in line with, what he and his friends had outlined as the new vision back in the 1940s. And I think Dylan helped bring Ginsberg into the 1960s. Ginsberg was very much coming out of the 40s and 50s. Dylan got him interested in music in different kinds of ways, in a kind of performance, a kind of countercultural performance in new kinds of ways. He also gave him a tape recorder upon which he recorded one of his great poems of that period, Wichita Vortex Sutra. So I think that the two of them affected each other in all kinds of ways, but mostly to the betterment of their respective arts.
We are a little past our midpoint. Sean Wilentz is our guest. He's professor of history at Princeton, and we are talking about his new book, Bob Dylan in America, and it's published by Doubleday. It's about Dylan and his music and about how he has shaped America, how he was shaped by America, and particularly looks at some of the things we've talked about Ginsberg, about the importance of the Beats. He has a section here about one record in particular, Blonde on Blonde, and also traces what Dylan has done really all the way through his career. And a lot of interesting things here. So if you're interested in Bob Dylan, or maybe you just haven't listened to his music in a long time and you want to refresh yourself, this might be a nice companion to some listening, Bob Dylan in America. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think I cut in on you there where you're going to say something.
No, it's just, Ginsberg and those are one of those influences, one of those circuits, Ginsberg to Dylan, that were pretty direct, although
yeah.
The beginning of that chapter in the book, I try to connect Aaron Copland to Bob Dylan via a movie based on the John Steinbeck novella of Mice and Men, which Jack Kerouac saw and later wrote about, and then some years after that, when they all get back to... When Dylan and Ginsberg go to Kerouac's grave, they actually read that poem. Uh-huh. It's a very complicated circuit, but I think it kind of works.
Yeah, we have a caller here in Edgewood, so we'll talk with them. This is line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there on line one? Go ahead.
Any comments on Modern Times and especially Working Man's Blues?
Modern Times, yes. That's a recent record, 2006, I believe. Working Man's Blues... which is a very strong song, I think, about how working people in America are getting screwed. It's also in part a tribute, I think, to Merle Haggard's song "Working Man Blues," which is about a very different take on the subject, which is about how the singer is never going to go on welfare and he's going to support his family and he has beer in a tavern every day. Dylan's is a different take on it, but it's at once his own. But I think it's also a tribute to Haggard. So, it's sort of typical in some ways, that song in particular, of his ability to look out in all sorts of realms of American culture, and then make it make something new out of it that's very much his own. And that happens on Modern Times a fair amount. I mean, he does a rewrite of I think Rollin' and Tumblin', isn't that on that record? Which is an old Muddy Waters standard, but he redoes it, and so that's very much in line with what I think his method has been over the last, or his approach has been over the last 10-15 years or so.
Well, I hope they get to the question of the caller. Others are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I'm interested in having you talk about is how, over time, people have reacted to Dylan's changes in direction and style and what he wanted to do. And I think particularly this is something actually that even goes back a long way to the point where, as you say, Dylan himself wanted, he was established as the heir to Woody Guthrie and the the lone troubadour on stage all along with his singing with his acoustic guitar. That was people had gotten used to that and
right.
loved that and wanted that.
Right.
And when then the day came, he decided he wanted to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
People got really upset.
Yes, they did.
About it. And, maybe there were some people who never did go with that. And maybe some other people said, well, okay, that's what you want to do. We'll give it a chance and see what we think. And I'm just the idea that people could get so so angry, so upset about a musician in change of direction that people can be that invested in art impresses me. And I also think it's something that maybe doesn't happen all that much.
Yeah. No, I don't think it does. I mean, Dylan's sort of an artist like Picasso in that sense, that he changes styles, you know, pretty dramatically as he's gone through his career. But people didn't get so shocked when or scandalized, I don't believe, as when Picasso began his blue period or something.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it was in part political. Certainly early on, the investment in Bob Dylan was not just aesthetic, it was also political. He was going to be a spokesman for a certain set of ideas. And when he moved first, even before he started playing with electrical instruments again, but when he first started writing much more personal songs, there were those who feared that he was abandoning his role as what they wanted him to be. And they were very invested in that. I mean, their own identity was invested in that, not just their appreciation of an artist, but their own sense of themselves. They made Bob Dylan into something that Bob Dylan had never wanted to be, which is a leader. You know, he writes later on, "Don't follow leaders, watch the parking meters." But he was their leader spiritually, and they had invested so much in him that when he rejected that, or seemed to reject it, I don't think he actually ever rejected anything, but he just moved on. They felt offended. They felt that their own sense of identity was being defiled, was being rejected in the most absolute kind of way. They felt betrayed. They felt as if this guy had betrayed them. And that was the first big one, and that's the famous, you know, I mean, it actually began before the Newport Festival in 1965 when he, quote-unquote, went electric.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly after 65, I mean, I was at a concert and not that long afterwards, and there were people there who came to boo, which, you know, kind of a waste of your money to go and boo somebody, but they felt that strongly about it.
Yeah.
But that's not the last time that happened. I mean, Dylan's always shocking people. I mean, he releases an album called Self-Portrait, which is a kind of weird amalgamation of songs that he thought were interesting, and people hated it and thought that Bob Dylan had again, gone off a direction they didn't like. The strongest of all may have been when he starts writing his gospel music in the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, where there's some very, very strong music, I think. But, you know, he had had an evangelical Christian conversion in 1979, and he started writing and singing in that vein. Some of it's quite hectoring, some of it's quite strident in the way that preachers can be. The man who had said he would never become a preacher had become exactly that. And I think, again, people felt betrayed. You know, for a secular Jew to suddenly become, I mean, secular Jew sort of countercultural type, to suddenly become an evangelical Christian right at the time that Ronald Reagan is getting elected president, people felt betrayed. But Dylan gets inside people's heads so that when he follows his muse, I think people are unwilling to do that. People are scared by it.
Yeah. You may serve the devil. You may serve the Lord. Got to serve somebody.
Exactly. Or Columbia Records.
Well, yeah, that's another thing. Let's talk with some more people who are listening. Champaign Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Comment on how these people paid their bills before they got famous. Like Kerouac used to ask his relatives for money.
Right.
Then recently Ginsberg got $2 million for selling his notebooks, but he had to pay a very high tax for lack of adequate planning. Okay,
right.
Thanks.
Well, and I think in the book you talk about how when Dylan was first becoming established, that for him it was a big thing to be making $50 a week.
Yeah, well, he finally got, you know, he got a big enough gig to be able to have an apartment in downtown New York, you know, in the village near his girlfriends and near the clubs. Bob Dylan's made a lot of money. But, you know, not as much as, you know, Britney Spears, I bet, but, you know, he's made a lot of money off of what he did, what he's done. But I think he's used it for his own purposes, and he's used some of it well, but in ways that people don't know about, sort of anonymously.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, the late critic Ellen Willis, who's one of my favorite rock critics of all time, had a very perceptive line about Dylan in a piece he wrote at the end of the 60s, which is that he's very shrewd about money, but he's not very materialistic. You know, when if you were to see him, you know, shambling along in his, you know, his hoodie and looking kind of inconspicuous. You know, he's not a guy who's interested in being rich. He just happens to be rich.
Yeah. Well, I think, and what maybe the caller also was alluding to, the fact that he and a lot of other people at the time that we're talking about in the, you know, the early to mid 60s, you wonder how it is they were actually managed to keep body and soul together.
Yeah.
You know, how did they actually pay the rent and buy food?
Right. Well, I mean, and for some people like Allen Ginsberg, that was a matter of choice. I mean, it was a matter of spiritual rigor. I mean, you know, it was about simplicity and mm-hmm. about stripping down. So for them to keep body and soul together was, you know, a pretty straightforward proposition. You didn't have to spend a lot of money to do that because you lived simply. With Dylan scuffled like everyone else, but he was fortunate in that he got a regular paying gig pretty early on at the Gaslight Cafe on McDougal Street. So he was able to afford that apartment, which was kind of shabby. But you know, he banged around for some time. The difference with him, and this was the subject of some jealousy or controversy among the inner circle of folk singers, was that he hooked up with a manager named Albert Grossman, mm-hmm. who was from Chicago and was very consciously and very astutely, from a business point of view, putting together what he thought of as the best acts from the folk revival, or some of them, and marketing them commercially and getting them decent contracts and making sure that they were getting paid what they were due. And a lot of people took that as a sellout. A lot of people took that as when Dylan signed on with Grossman, and then you know, after he had already signed on with Columbia Records, that these were somehow sellouts, that you weren't supposed to be successful. And for Dylan, this is all very, you know, perplexing, because while he, you know, had struggled like any other young artist, he had never taken a vow of poverty. You know, he was interested in becoming a star as much as anything else. So, you know, a lot of people, with a certain degree of hypocrisy. You know, Dave Van Ronk in the movie that Martin Scorsese made about Dylan says, you know, that a lot of those people, you know, had to take a good look in the mirror and realize that they were just as eager to have that kind of success as Dylan was. It just that Dylan got it and they didn't. Mm. But in any case, the whole theme of that is interesting. But yes, he's paid his dues. I mean, every artist has to, and he certainly did in his case.
All right, let's talk with someone in Belgium, the community Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Okay, yeah, hello.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
Okay. Thank you about this show, about this program. Thank you about talking about Robert Zimmerman.
Obviously, here the callers are referring to the fact that Bob Dylan was he was not born Bob Dylan. He was born Bob Zimmerman.
Right.
That's right.
Well, yeah, he starts out in Hibbing, Minnesota. There's a small Jewish community up in the Iron Range, and he's very much a part of it. And he comes to Minneapolis and becomes a folk singer, takes up the folk music stuff, and then changes his name to Bob Dylan. You know, it's a great old you know, tradition. You know, Judy Garland came up from up that way. That was not her real name either. It's, you know, he took a stage name, and you know, the late Tony Curtis was originally Bernie Schwartz. So he took his name, and it was a very artistic name, or at least it sounded that way. But you know, Dylan's always he both had to leave all of that, like many, you know, the usual story of the kid from the provincial town, although Hibbing had its cultural riches, to be sure. But he had to leave there to go to New York, changed everything, and made it big. But you know, he continued to be very close to Minnesota. Has very close ties there. He still goes out there, close to his mother in particular, who until she died in 2000-2001, you know, was very much a force in his life, and he's a family man in many ways. And Minnesota is very much a part of that, as is the religious dimension. So, you know, he's an oddly, we would think of it as schizzy. I mean, on the one hand, he becomes this other character, but he has a very, very strong private life, which includes a great deal of Robert Zimmerman in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the call. I'm glad you're enjoying the show. You know, we got about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to play a little bit more music, and I wanted to play something from Blonde on Blonde, and I thought I'd pick something here. At least it's a little shorter, so maybe play the whole thing. And it's something that I just there's a lot of really good songs on here. It's kind of hard to pick just one thing, but I thought maybe we might play "Pledging My Time."
Okay,
this is the second cut on Blonde. It's Bob Dylan from 1966. And that is Bob Dylan, Pledging My Time, from the album Blonde on Blondes, recorded in 1966. And that's, and you can maybe see why people reacted they did, or can understand how they did, because this is a very different Bob Dylan than and Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Sure is. This is recorded in Nashville, and it's part of Blonde on Blonde, and I write about in the book about how that song, among others, came together. It was originally entitled What You Can Do With My Wigwam. And they turned it into Pledging My Time with a lot of, shows the influence of Elmore James, a great Mississippi blues guitar player, and particularly his song, It Hurts Me Too. But you can see, I mean, the evolution of that song was one of the more interesting parts of the session tapes, and Robbie Robertson's contribution to that is really important, along with a guy named Pig Robbins, who was a piano player.
Yeah, and this on this album, Robbie Robertson plays, Levon Helm plays.
Actually, no, Levon doesn't play.
Oh, he doesn't play. And there was some of the other guys, though, that eventually went on to be the band.
Yeah,
that were all involved in this. And I thought that he did.
No, it's there's one session in which Rick Danko, who was the bass player,
yeah.
York session. They had started to play with the band early on, but it didn't quite work out. Nothing quite gelled, which is why they moved to Nashville. But he brought along to Nashville Robbie Robertson and Al Cooper, who was his great session man from
the album. And he's the guy who's playing the keyboards.
Yes, absolutely.
On this. And that's, I think, another thing that strikes me about this, listening to these songs, is the sense of humor. It may be rueful, but the wonderful sense of humor that there is in these songs.
People underestimate Bob Dylan's humor all of the time. I mean, his songs are really funny. A lot of them are. Or there's a sort of mordant cutting edge of humor at some points. But sometimes they're just flat out funny. And that continues to this day when he's, you know, inserting vaudeville jokes. I'm sitting on my watch so I can be on time. I mean, that's a kind of silly, hokey thing, but there it is. No, Dylan's very, very funny, as well as very hopeful. I mean, all of his songs, no matter how desolate they can be, they always end with a kind of sign of good luck, hope you make it.
Yeah. He's 69. He's still performing. In fact, he's going to be here in 2 weeks.
Fantastic!
Playing
great.
Here in 2 weeks with his band, and I think it's amazing. That's an amazing longevity for a performer. The fact that you would still have ideas, still want to play, still have the energy, and that there are still people that want to hear you all these many years later. I think that's pretty amazing.
It's amazing for the rock and roll generation. You know, you think of this. I mean, you know, Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones are still doing it, but not that many. Paul McCartney's still doing it. Ringo Starr, but there aren't that many who are. You know, as you say, people actually want to go here. But, you know, of another generation of early rock and rollers or the blues guys in particular, I mean, Muddy Waters was going on until he was, you know, pretty old. In fact, the whole folk revival, by the time the folk revival found these guys, they were already pretty old, guys like Son House and others. So Dylan, in some ways, is doing what, you know, really talented musicians do, which is to perform, and he's on the road. He gives 100 shows a year or sometimes more. And, you know, this is his life. It's also, you know, when you hear the songs, and I hope, you know, enough of your listeners will get to go and hear him when he comes in 2 weeks. You know, it's not an oldie show. He'll sing old songs, but they sound very, very different than what you might remember on the record. You know, he's not there kind of just reproducing his older stuff. He's there reinventing his older stuff and then giving you his new inventions. And it means that not every show is as good as the others. Some of them are okay. Some of them are great. Some of them, you know, not so hot. But it's always an experience going to a Bob Dylan show.
Yeah. Well, and maybe people will be. I think there are still tickets, so that maybe people will take advantage of the opportunity to see him. And I guess I'm also right at the beginning. You know, we heard the promo for Fresh Air and mentioned the fact that tomorrow would have been John Lennon's 70th birthday. It seems I can't quite actually cope with the idea of All of us being as much older as we are.
Welcome to the other side.
maybe I'll refrain from echoing Pete Townsend about dying before I get old. I don't know. It's really interesting to think about how much time has passed.
I would have loved to have heard John Lennon talk about what it's like to be 70. I mean, you know, he didn't realize it at the time because of the shock of his murder. But Bob Dylan has done is written songs which are about getting older. And on Time Out of Mind in particular, I'm thinking of a song called Not Dark Yet, which is about not being really, really old, but getting there. You know, his work has continued to shine, but it explores what it is like for him to be who he is right now. And, you know, the idea of elderly rock and roll for old people, it may not have struck people as interesting because, you know, rock and roll is quintessentially about being an adolescent, right, and rebellious and, you know, sexually charged and all that. But there is a way, and this is what's make Dylan and I know Lennon would have done the same, so powerful is that he can write about what it's like to be, you know, 55, 60.